Hi there. I'm Liza Powell O'Brien, and I'm a writer, a reader, and the wife of someone you may have heard of. And I'm here to tell you about the newest season of my podcast for Team Coco, Significant Others. Each week, we tell stories you may not know about a person you probably do, like Benedict Arnold, whose wife Peggy may be the reason he almost succeeded in betraying his country. Each week, we'll share another story of someone who existed just beyond the spotlight of history. And then we'll have a follow-up conversation with an expert who can help us unpack the story even further. Look for Significant Others wherever you get your podcasts.
And when it was all over, I said to myself, is that all there is to a fire?
In 1970, Peggy Lee won a Grammy for Is That All There Is? A song many heard as an anthem of ennui, but not Peggy.
She saw it as absolutely life-affirming and hopeful,
yeah,
that bad things are going to happen and that you can rise above them.
Let's break out the booze.
Stand back and have a ball. Celebrate life in spite of all of this that's happening.
And Peggy Lee had a lot to celebrate. At 50, she was already a legend, an artist of astonishing versatility.
Don't cry.
A heartbreaker.
There'll be another spring.
A trailblazer. And a master of cool.
When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever.
Musically, how many different Peggy Lees were there?
God.
Dozens.
Watch that fringe and see how it flutters. When
there's Latin.
Sugar.
There's blues.
Things are swinging.
There's jazz.
Pass me by.
There's pop.
Creatively, she seemed utterly unafraid.
Oh, you want me to do The Folks Who Live on the Hill? So you'll weep? I can do that. You want me to do Black Coffee? So you think it's like, oh, I'm hanging out with junkies at a kitchen table? I can do that.
Personally, she was more conflicted.
I never wanted to be a star.
Yeah.
I wanted to sing around the house and paint and write and raise babies and those kind of things.
She would say that all the time.
Do you think that was what she wanted?
I think it was on some level what she wanted, but...
But that compulsion to create...
She couldn't tamp it down.
There was nobody like her. Andre Previn, who was a jazz pianist and played with all of them, he told me that he thought she was the best of them all.
Does she get the respect she deserves today?
No. And when Sir Andre Previn says to me she's better than Ella because Ella could only do certain things at which she was the best, but Peggy could do everything, that was the curse.
From CBS Sunday Morning and iHeart, I'm Mo Rocca, and this is Mobituaries. This Mobit, Peggy Lee, January 21st, 2002, The Death of Cool. I came to Peggy Lee relatively late in life. You know how kids are drawn to big, bold colors? Well, growing up, I was drawn to big, bold voices, like Pat Benatar.
We're running with the shadows of the night.
Or Broadway's Laurie Beachman, belting it out in Annie.
NYC, just got here this morning.
And of course, Barbara. always Barbara. But Peggy Lee? She was more my father's generation of music. Wasn't she that woman who sang about the doggy in the window?
How much is that doggy in the window?
Sorry, that was Patti Page. And no disrespect to Patti Page. Her Tennessee Waltz undoes me every time. The first time I really paid any attention to Peggy Lee was, well, naturally, in 1997, when comedian Ellen DeGeneres came out to ABC's Diane Sawyer and 40 million other people in a nationally televised interview.
Did you have sexual relations with men?
I slept with two men. Yes. Didn't like it. Didn't like it. That Peggy Lee song, Is That All There Is? That was going over and over in my head the first time. I just kept singing, Is That All There Is, My Dear? Then Let's Keep Dancing. I thought, am I crazy? Because I shouldn't be hearing Peggy Lee right now.
Of course, when I profiled Ellen in 2011 for CBS Sunday Morning, I had to ask about that.
I've always wanted to know, after the interview when you came out, did Peggy Lee get in contact with you?
No. She didn't. That's a good question, though. But I bet I'm not the only person who had sex and for the first time and had that Peggy Lee song, Is That All There Is, in their head. She did Is That All There Is and You Give Me Fever. So yeah. Something must have changed. She must have switched partners.
Right. It's probably okay. True.
Good.
It was then that I started to give Peggy Lee a real listen, and I came to appreciate the shades of gray in her voice. She could swing with the best of them, but she was more likely to hold back, like she was keeping a secret.
Play it again, Johnny Guitar.
Who was this woman? Where did she come from?
And that wind, it's like a rumbling.
It's powerful. Feels like it could blow this house down.
I met Peggy Lee's granddaughter, Holly Foster Wells, on the second floor of an old train depot in the tiny town of Wimbledon, North Dakota. There's no other way to put it. This place is in the middle of nowhere, 30 miles from the big city of Jamestown, North Dakota, where Peggy was born in 1920. Today, this train depot is the Peggy Lee Museum. It's also where Peggy lived when she was a teenager. Or standing in her bedroom.
The first time I came here and I walked upstairs and I stood in front of this window, I burst into tears.
By the way, Holly really looks like her grandmother. Blonde hair, same big bright eyes.
Even today, when we've been talking here, it's like I feel her here.
Peggy was still Norma Dolores Eggstrom when she lived here.
She wouldn't have been Peggy Lee without Norma. She wouldn't have been Peggy Lee without this heartache.
And the heartache started early.
Her mother passed away when she was 4. It was a traumatic event that I think that was kind of the beginning of her search for healing.
Norma adored her father, who was the town's railroad depot manager, but he was an alcoholic.
She helped run the depot when her dad wasn't in a good place.
Even worse, the woman her father remarried was abusive. Peggy later claimed her stepmother once beat her over the head with a cast iron skillet.
So I went through all that and I learned a great deal from that.
That's Peggy talking to CBS much later in 1986.
I learned how to run real fast. A few other things like that.
She said she would look out at the railroad tracks and just imagine where they led. And she said, one day I'm going to leave this place as soon as I know where those train tracks lead. And it was a way out. And of course, her other way out was music.
Now, radio was still a relatively new technology, around the time Norma entered high school in the early 1930s. Tuning the dials of her Atwater Kent 5-tube radio receiver, she fell in love with the voices of Maxine Sullivan.
Oh, you'll take the high road and I'll take the low road. I'll be in Scotland for you.
A young Louis Armstrong.
I'm so happy as can be when they swing that music for me.
And Billie Holiday.
Can't you see you've got to be my mother's son-in-law?
Yes, this white girl from the tundra who had only ever sung hymns at her Lutheran church is listening mostly to black artists. But that's the music that spoke to her. At 17, Norma was invited to audition for the biggest radio station in North Dakota.
This is WDAY Fargo.
WDAY Fargo. That's when program director Ken Kennedy made a fateful decision, as she later recalled in a 1975 interview.
The name Norma Eggstrom didn't sound right. He said, let's see, you look like a Peggy. Peggy what? And he tried a few names and came up with Lee. And that was really how it started.
She had the Peggy Lee name. The Peggy Lee sound came 2 years later after she'd made her way to California. Still unknown, she was singing at the Dollhouse Restaurant in Palm Springs before a raucous crowd celebrating comedian Jack Benny's birthday. Biographer Peter Richmond, author of Fever, The Life and Music of Miss Peggy Lee, describes the scene.
People are just laughing, and so she's getting pissed off. And she's only like 19, and she's singing in a good club in front of celebrities. She's pissed.
And that's when Peggy decided if she couldn't sing over them, she'd sing under them.
So she starts singing softer and softer until people start getting quiet because they can't hear her singing. And now they're listening, and now they're captured. That's when she understood volume wasn't going to be the thing. Nuance was going to be the thing.
Moments like this make me thrill through and through.
Now, there's no recording from that evening, but here she is decades later, casting a similar spell over the crowd at Manhattan's Basin Street East Club.
She knew that the more she could get the room silent, the more she's got them.
Nonchalantly, we dine. And
she said the challenge is to leave out all but the essentials.
Peggy would cultivate a style that was as minimalist as the landscape she'd grown up in. Cool, but never cold. While singing in Chicago in 1941, Peggy was discovered by the King of Swing, Benny Goodman, one of the era's biggest band leaders. Now, Goodman didn't much respect his so-called girl singers, and Peggy was intimidated by the famously perfectionist Goodman. But when he noticed the 21-year-old Peggy carrying around a prized possession, a record of blues singer Lil Green's Why Don't You Do Right, he was intrigued.
You had plenty of money in 1922.
Goodman decided to let Peggy record her own version, and it became her first hit.
You let other women make a fool of you. Why don't you do right?
She doesn't even have to worry about finding the rhythm from the drummer or the bass player or Benny. They're following her rhythm.
Get out of here and get me some money too.
It was while touring with Benny Goodman that Peggy, often the only woman on the bus, met guitarist Dave Barber, and the two struck up a romance. That didn't go over well with Goodman, though, and Barber was fired from the band for, quote-unquote, fraternizing with the girl singer. But Peggy liked Dave. I mean, she really liked him. And so she quit. She married Dave Barber and gave birth to their daughter Nikki later that year.
They had such chemistry together. That was the love of her life, my grandfather.
There's this duet they wrote and recorded together called I Don't Know Enough About You they filmed the performance, sort of an early music video.
I know a little bit about a lot of things, but I don't know enough about you.
Peggy is playing a teacher, sitting at a desk, fiddling with a pair of glasses. She looks so healthy, happy, and gorgeous. Dave Barber sits off to the side, strumming his guitar. These are two people so at ease with each other, the picture of contentment.
You get me in a spin. Oh, what a stew I'm in.
But Dave, like Peggy's father, had a drinking problem. And as Peggy's star rose, Dave's drinking only got worse.
And it broke her heart. But just as she always has done, it fueled her music.
'Cause I don't know enough about you.
After 8 years of marriage, Dave Barber and Peggy Lee filed for divorce. Coming up, personally, Peggy takes on the 1950s as a single mother. Artistically, she ends up owning the decade.
Hi there. I'm Liza Powell O'Brien, and I'm a writer, a reader, and the wife of someone you may have heard of. And I'm here to tell you about the newest season of my podcast for Team Coco, Significant Others. Each week, we tell stories you may not know about a person you probably do, like Benedict Arnold, whose wife Peggy may be the reason he almost succeeded in betraying his country. Each week, we'll share another story of someone who existed just beyond the spotlight of history. And then we'll have a follow-up conversation with an expert who can help us unpack the story even further. Look for Significant Others wherever you get your podcasts.
Person to Person with Charles Collingwood.
In 1960, cameras from the CBS TV interview series Person to Person visited Peggy Lee at her sprawling Beverly Hills mansion, also known as the Peach Palace.
Well, now you've achieved quite a few goals up to now. What was your main goal as a youngster in Jamestown, North Dakota?
Well, Charles, I had two goals, really. One was to be a successful singer, and the other was to have a family, and I've been very happy about having some success, and I have a wonderful daughter. And, of course, as I've gone along, I've picked up a few more goals, so I think it's good to have a goal, don't you, Charles?
I think it is.
Now, when Peggy says she'd had some success, that's an understatement. In just the previous decade, she had achieved more than most artists could hope to in a lifetime. In this act, we're going to talk about what made Peggy Lee one of the most important musical artists of the 1950s.
Yes, it's a good day for singing a song, and it's a good day for moving along.
For one thing, she was a prolific singer-songwriter, a rarity for women back then. She co-wrote It's a Good Day with Dave Barber. Peggy was always writing. Back in North Dakota, she wrote poetry. And ultimately, she had credits on more than 250 songs. Sad songs.
Then was then, and now is now.
Happy songs.
I Like a Dance by Fred Astaire. And Brando's eyes, Yul Brynner's hair. But I think to tell you's only fair that I love being here with you.
And a certain Disney classic.
What a dog.
As a kid, was it really cool for you that your grandmother was part of Lady and the Tramp?
So that's how my friends knew of her.
That's Peggy's granddaughter, Holly Foster Wells, again. Peggy co-wrote the score to Lady and the Tramp, but that's not all she did on the movie.
She's the voice of the Siamese cats. She's Darling, the mother. She's Peg in the Dog Pound.
He's a tramp, but I love him. Yes, even I have got it pretty bad.
My grandmother had a film projector in her house, and she would take out that film every year, and we would watch it in the living room.
Sidebar, that same year, 1955, Peggy scored an Oscar nomination, playing an alcoholic saloon singer in the film Pete Kelly's Blues. This is a sidebar because, well, we don't have time to get into all the things that Peggy did in the 1950s. Blame her for being so productive. Now, in addition to all the songs Peggy wrote, there are the ones she all but rewrote. Peggy covered a lot of popular songs, often breathing new life into them. She took the song Heart from the Broadway show Damn Yankees.
You gotta have heart.
And gave it a Latin beat.
You gotta have heart. All you really need is heart. Corazón.
She took the song Lover, a waltz from the Rodgers and Hart musical Love Me Tonight. And, well, listen to what she did to that.
Lover, please be tender when your tender feels depart. Lover.
She takes that and turns it into something kind of wild.
Her final notes have been likened to an orgasm.
And in 1958, she took the song Fever, originally recorded by R&B singer Little Willie John.
You never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care.
And gave it a new, stripped-down arrangement. Just bass, drums, and finger snaps.
Never know how much I love you.
She's keeping so much in. If this is the only thing to signal what you're singing about, that's powerful.
When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever.
It became the biggest hit of her career. That sequence in the middle that sounds almost like beat poetry.
Romeo loved Juliet.
Peggy wrote that.
She felt the same. When he put his arms around her, he said, Julie, baby, you're my flame, thou givest fever.
Also, listen to the way she delivers those lines. Peggy had been blurring the line between talking and singing as far back as her Benny Goodman days. Here she is on Cole Porter's Let's Do It back in 1941.
Up in Lapland, little, let's do it. Well, let's do it. Let's fall in love.
The way she just tosses off the words, let's do it, Peggy came up with that. Now, Fever may have been Peggy's biggest commercial success, but her artistic apex came with the release of the album Black Coffee.
You can really feel her coming into the kitchen after a long night and just looking at the coffee and saying, wow, it was worth it last night, but I gotta have that coffee now.
Here she is on the album's title track.
Black coffee, love's a hand-me-down brew.
Black Coffee was one of the very first concept albums ever recorded. It's about a woman's lonesome experience being in love with a man she can't trust. The milestone record is now considered one of the best vocal albums in jazz history.
She becomes cool in that album.
Black Coffee also cemented Lee's status as the high priestess of pop jazz, acclaimed by critics and the masses alike.
Could Peggy Lee have only happened at the time that she did?
Yes.
Biographer Peter Richmond says Peggy was peaking just as black and white musical traditions were intermingling in the mainstream.
Peggy was able to incorporate so many different rhythms and emotions. And she was, and I really think I can say this, she was unique. There was nobody like her.
Later in her career, Peggy told one writer, quote, "I'm not really a white singer. I sing black. I always have." Now, when Peggy made that comment in 1974, it had to have rankled many, just as it certainly would today. There's a terrific essay about Peggy Lee written by culture critic Gerald Early. He's a professor of English and African American studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Early writes about the profoundly uneasy history of white performers emulating a black sound, from Louis Prima to Elvis to Eminem. Peggy, he points out, didn't just emulate black singers. She literally and famously would imitate Billie Holiday.
I fell in love with you first time I looked into them eyes. You got a certain little cute way of flirting with their eyes.
So what was that about? Was she a big fan of Billie Holiday's?
She was a huge fan of Billie Holiday's. She absolutely loved her music. And I heard that Billie Holiday, well, wasn't so crazy about my grandmother because I heard that she felt like not just my grandmother, but other people too copied her. But as my grandmother's voice matured and her career developed, you don't hear anybody but Peggy Lee.
Gerald Early in that essay seems to agree that Peggy was an original. He writes that she invented the hip white female vocalist. He describes Peggy's imitation of Billie Holiday as more than, quote, some sort of lame white girl imitation of the great black jazz singer. It was an expression of how accomplished Lee was as a jazz singer and how much she respected Holiday, end quote. Peggy Lee had deep bonds with black artists throughout her career. She was an early champion and friend of Ray Charles. When one of her childhood idols, Louis Armstrong, died in 1971, it was Peggy Lee who was invited to sing the Lord's Prayer at his funeral.
For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory.
And when CBS aired a star-studded tribute to Duke Ellington, produced by Quincy Jones, Peggy Lee was the only white solo artist featured, alongside Sarah Vaughan, Roberta Flack, and Aretha Franklin. "If I'm the Duke," Ellington once said, "Peggy Lee is Queen." Peggy had earned that title in the 1950s. She was no longer just a big band singer, Benny Goodman's canary. Critically and commercially, she was an artist of the highest order, on a par with Frank Sinatra. But for all the hit songs she'd recorded, the one that was closest to her heart wasn't one she'd written or radically reimagined.
Someday we'll build a home on a hilltop high, you and I.
So the folks who live on the hill, that's her very favorite song. And I think it just paints this picture of an idyllic relationship and growing old together and always having that soulmate by your side.
Peggy recorded it in 1957. The song was written by Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein 20 years earlier as a romantic reverie.
But we will always be called.
But Peggy's version is different. She's singing about something that was never to be.
On the hill.
That trumpet, it's just so plaintive.
The mournfulness of wishing a house on the hill that will never be yours and really doesn't exist.
And that's what she really wanted. That's what she hoped to have with my grandfather. And she married three more times after that. But it was not. She called those costume parties, actually.
What did that mean?
Well, I think she didn't think they were real. They weren't real love affairs. She certainly fell in love with many people throughout the years.
I just think maybe it was too much for these men to be Mr. Peggy Lee. And then I don't know that any man could have really given her the love that she wanted. The closest she got to getting that love, I think, was from the audience.
On the other side of the break, Miss Peggy Lee, the icon.
Hi there. I'm Liza Powell O'Brien, and I'm a writer, a reader, and the wife of someone you may have heard of. And I'm here to tell you about the newest season of my podcast for Team Coco, Significant Others. Each week, we tell stories you may not know about a person you probably do, like Benedict Arnold, whose wife Peggy may be the reason he almost succeeded in betraying his country. Each week, we'll share another story of someone who existed just beyond the spotlight of history. And then we'll have a follow-up conversation with an expert who can help us unpack the story even further. Look for Significant Others wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, I can scoop up a great big dipper full of lard from the drippings can. Throw it in the skillet, go out and do my shopping, and be back before it melts in my pan. 'Cause I'm a woman.
By the 1970s, Peggy Lee had become Miss Peggy Lee, a bona fide icon. She even inspired the Muppets character Miss Piggy, originally named Miss Piggy Lee.
Feed the baby, grease the car, and powder my face all at the same time.
She thought that was pretty fantastic. I mean, that pig is glamorous.
Miss Piggy is the paragon of glamour.
Right. And she's a diva, and my grandma was a diva. So.
Growing up in that era, Holly Foster Wells spent summers touring with her grandmother, beginning when she was just six. And frankly, I'm kind of jealous.
So you would go on the road with her?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
She would take me all over the world. I would dress up in her gowns, and we would have breakfast in bed. We'd watch soap operas, and then it would be time to get ready for the show. Then we had to get serious, because that was a process of becoming Miss Peggy Lee. Yeah, it was like a four-hour process. And she'd start first with a bubble bath, and then the makeup, and then the hair, and the gowns.
There's a great story about a fan meeting her grandmother in an elevator on the day of one of her shows.
She had a scarf, and she had curlers and sunglasses, and someone looked at her and said, "Are you Peggy Lee?" And she said, "Not yet."
Now, we've talked plenty about Peggy as a recording artist, but we haven't really touched on her as a live performer.
I would just be in awe of what she could do. And I would see grown men crying, and I would see couples holding hands, and people, you could hear a pin drop. And so it was really mesmerizing.
There's a tape of her singing C.C. Rider.
Oh, yeah.
And it's hypnotic.
I know exactly what performance that is, and she barely moves. Like, she just moves a little shoulder and just her face, and it's so sexy.
That performance was at Basin Street East. We mentioned it earlier, a legendary Manhattan nightclub that no longer exists.
Now, I can tell you that if I could get in a time machine and go back and hear her live, I would choose to go back to Basin Street East, the club in New York City, where she really triumphed.
Am yes, I right? Absolutely. And if I could go back in a time machine, that's when I would go back to.
All right,
too,
because well, you're my plus one, or I'm your plus one.
Exactly.
We don't have a time machine, but luckily, Peggy recorded everything on reel-to-reel tapes, from sessions with her musicians.
I start in a hurry because one thing isn't very clear, my love. Should the teacher stand so near, my love?
To sessions with her psychic.
How many times have you been married?
Well, married once and sort of married three times, so it's four.
Right.
And lucky us, Holly has agreed to play some of those recordings, including a behind-the-scenes moment with Peggy and one of her favorite artists.
Well, my grandmother loved the music of Ray Charles. He pitched to her a song he'd written called Tell All the World About You.
You're so fine and you're so sweet. How's it going now? Can't think of it now.
Okay.
You're so sweet and you're so fine. Oh, my goodness. I can't even remember my own tune. That's bad.
I gotta do this.
And then she actually went in and recorded it. She put her own spin on it.
You're so fine and you're so sweet. You kind of love and just can't be beat. I wanna walk about and talk about and tell all the world about you.
Peggy's home recordings also capture her goofing around with family.
So my grandmother was rehearsing at home, and my dad and my mom and my brother were watching her rehearsal. And then in the middle of it, she just decides to bring out balloons and start sucking helium.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Three bags full. One for my master, one for my dame, one for the little boy who lives in a lane.
Yes, that's Peggy Lee singing on helium.
Bob, Bob, let's keep everyone in one. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Three bags full.
By the early 1980s, Peggy was thinking seriously about legacy. In 1981, the great Lena Horne had a smash hit with her own one-woman Broadway show. Now it was Peggy's turn, as the 63-year-old discussed with NBC's Gene Shalit in 1983.
Peggy, you've got a new show coming on Broadway called Peg.
Right.
So I want to know about that.
Well, it's called Peg because it's about my life. And I wrote it. And I started writing this for someone else to play.
I mean, there was going to be a show about you, but someone else would play your life.
Yes.
That chance. I mean, who else was going to play Peggy? Peg was a musical, of course, with original songs, mostly co-written by Peggy. It opened on December 14th, 1983. It closed 3 days later.
It was one of, I would say, her greatest failures, actually, in her career. She was really, really just devastated. It felt like a rejection of her life.
Because the show was autobiographical. It was about her life.
But and quite frankly, some people felt it was too depressing.
There was one song about Peggy's stepmother beating her. It was an up-tempo song.
For 11 years, there was at least one beating a day. One beating a day. For 11 years, there was at least one beating a day. So many.
Do you remember how the audience in the Broadway theater reacted to that?
That was an awkward moment in the show because people didn't know if they should laugh or cry. It was confusing.
In the New York Times, Frank Rich wrote, "For those who respect Peggy Lee as a vocalist, but who don't worship her as a public personality, Peg may seem bizarre." And that was one of the nicer things written about it.
And I can imagine that the reaction to that probably really shook her and made her think, have I just lost my touch?
I remember her being defensive, like, this is my life. Like, wait, I'm so sorry if this is sad for you or hard for you, but this is my life. Like, I'm just telling you what I went through. And if it's hard for you to hear about, think about how it was to live it.
And away from Broadway, Peggy Lee's live performances weren't hitting like they used to.
So she aged, but these songs didn't age with her. So she sometimes would approach them in a campy way. And I don't know how that resonated with audiences, if they liked it or not.
With her oversized sunglasses and outlandish wigs and caftans, Peggy was becoming a punchline.
I would be backstage with her, and during intermission, she would want me to give her honest feedback about what people were thinking in the audience. And she'd go on stage, I'd run out, watch the show, and I'd even go and listen in the ladies' room to what people were saying. And there came a time when I didn't want to tell her those comments anymore because people were really critical. Like, oh, she sounds good, but she doesn't have the voice that she used to have. Or, wow, she's gained weight. Or, wow. Or, you know, that people are really, they come in with their own expectations.
There were things that were hard for you to hear and
right.
And hard to report back.
Right, and things that I didn't want to tell her, you know. It was hard.
By this point, Peggy's health was failing, in part due to exhaustion.
She really never took a vacation. She would write about places like Paris, but she wouldn't go there. She didn't go there and slow down.
After a bad case of pneumonia, she became dependent on an oxygen tank. By the 1990s, she was using a wheelchair and suffering complications due to her diabetes and spending more and more time at home in bed.
And how long would she be in bed?
Sometimes she could just be in bed until the next time she went on the road.
Which could be...
months. Yes.
Months.
And she learned to do everything from her bed, from her bedroom. So it was like an office. She would write songs in her bed. There's one I want to play for you that's so beautiful.
I've been too lonely for too long, and I'm too much in love to care.
So gorgeous, so much longing.
That's why we're all drawn to her songs, though. It's that longing that we all have, and then she just puts it into words and song for us.
I try so hard, but I can't see. I guess I wouldn't know the right one for me, 'cause I've been too long.
Were there times when you'd see her in bed and think, you know, I wonder if she could get up and walk out of here?
She absolutely could. And I know that because, well, she would have dinner parties where she would at least go from the bedroom to the dining room. But there was also a time when I got in a car accident. Someone T-boned me in an intersection and really badly destroyed my car. I was okay, thank goodness. But I called her, and she was there in like 10 minutes with her turban on and her sunglasses, looking very glamorous. But she was there in 10 minutes.
In 1995, a 75-year-old Peggy Lee performed from a wheelchair at the Hollywood Bowl. After the show that night, Holly told her grandmother that it was time.
I just said, it just seems like it's getting harder for you. She didn't ever want to be thought of as a joke. She wanted to go out on a high, and that was the end. That was the last performance.
Holly says Peggy remained a romantic until the very end.
One of the ways I know that is when I fell in love with my husband and told her, like, oh, mama, I've met a boy, and she wanted to know everything. It was like she was reading a romance novel. She just ate it up. She, at that point, was beyond romance for herself, but she loved watching me have a romance. And I'm so grateful that she was able to be at our wedding. We got married in June of 1998, and she had her stroke in October.
Peggy Lee died of a heart attack on January 21st, 2002, at the age of 81. There's a PBS documentary on Peggy that was made in 1969, the year before she released Is That All There Is? Peggy is wry and sophisticated here, an artist who knows what she wants.
I choose material that lets me tell a story, you know. It's a nice way to make a living.
I once talked to a musician who said your voice is one of the greatest musical instruments ever created.
Well, whoever that was, I love it.
And yet, there's something about the way she's wearing her hair here.
You can see her artistry, but she's wearing her hair in pigtails. So there's something also kind of girlish at the same time.
Yes. Yes. I always said there was a little girl in her. Sometimes I would see that childlike quality. And I think she was always looking for our mom. She was a powerful woman with a powerful career, but there was that little girl there always.
What do you think she was trying to do with her voice?
She had to get out of the childhood, physically, as well as metaphorically.
That's biographer Peter Richmond again.
She had to leave behind the thing she was leaving. And she's doing it with one tool, the voice and the rhythm and the perfect pitch and the talent she had in writing lyrics that others couldn't. That was her way of healing a psychic wound.
She said she wanted to leave a legacy, and she really did.
One final note. Today, Holly Foster Wells manages the Peggy Lee Estate, which includes all those songs her grandmother wrote. Despite offers, Peggy never sold the rights to her written work. Just like Dolly Parton, Joni Mitchell, Taylor Swift, great singer-songwriters who came after her, Peggy Lee understood the value of what she had created.
And it's a good day for shining your shoes, and it's a good day for losing the blues. Everything you gain.
I certainly hope you enjoyed this Mobituary. May I ask you to please rate and review our podcast? You can also follow Mobituaries on Facebook and Instagram. And you can follow me on the social media platform formerly known as Twitter, @Moraka. Hear all new episodes of Mobituaries every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts. And check out Mobituaries: Great Lives Worth Reliving, the New York Times best-selling book, now available in paperback and audiobook. It includes plenty of stories not in the podcast. This episode of Mobituaries was produced by Aaron Schrank. Our team of producers also includes Hazel Bryan and me, Moraka, with engineering by Josh Hahn. Our theme music is written by Daniel Hart. Our archival producer is Jamie Benson. Mobituaries' production company is Neon Hum Media. The original television version of this story was produced for CBS Sunday Morning by John DeMilio and edited by Steven Tyler. Indispensable support from Alan Pang, Reggie Bazile, and everyone at CBS News Radio. Special thanks to Holly Foster Wells and the estate of Peggy Lee, Steve Razies, Rand Morrison, Craig Swagler, Mike Hernandez, Alberto Robina, and Francisco Robina. Executive producers for Mobituaries include Megan Marcus, Jonathan Hirsch, and Mo Rocca. The series is created by yours truly.
Hi there. I'm Liza Powell O'Brien, and I'm a writer, a reader, and the wife of someone you may have heard of. And I'm here to tell you about the newest season of my podcast for Team Coco, Significant Others. Each week, we tell stories you may not know about a person you probably do, like Benedict Arnold, whose wife Peggy may be the reason he almost succeeded in betraying his country. Each week, we'll share another story of someone who existed just beyond the spotlight of history. And then we'll have a follow-up conversation with an expert who can help us unpack the story even further. Look for Significant Others wherever you get your podcasts.